Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Professor Don Olcott in this episode. Don has served in distance education roles across the globe, and his work in cross-border higher education, sustainable ODL and OER business models, innovative learning design models for ODL and OER, and leadership and innovation takes place across ongoing contributions to international journals and professional associations. I'm talking with Dr. Don Olcott, Professor of Educational Leadership and Open and Distance Learning with the University of Maryland Global Campus. He's based in Romania. Don has considerable international experience across digital and virtual education and is professionally connected with EDEN as Senior Fellow, the ICDE as an OER advocate, and across multiple editorial boards related to open and distance education. Don, it's great to be talking with you.
Thanks, Mark. Great to be here.
Can we begin with a brief overview of your career and publications?
Interestingly, I got into this field in distance education about the mid-1980s, primarily working in rural education. I actually was able to get in at a time when I got to observe firsthand a very positive use of technology. We had a lot of rural high schools that couldn't hire teachers in advanced mathematics and languages. And so four or five of the major universities in the central part of the U.S. got together, created a consortium, and delivered via satellite these courses to these high schools. So if you can imagine for just a moment, the high school 12th graders being taught by full professors at universities. So they thought they were in second heaven. I mean, this was just wonderful. It was a great cause because it helped them to finish their high school diploma. And yet here you had these tenured professors teaching these young people. So what an impression and what a great use of distance education. So what a great positive experience for me right out of the gates. The late 1980s in the U.S. was a time of transition with technologies, as it was in other places around the world. We were moving out of satellite broadcasting. We were CD-ROMs. We had a technology called instructional television fixed service, which was a line of sight, 20 miles kind of thing. And of course, traditional correspondence and audio conferencing. I mean, back in those days, I actually taught courses, just like we're doing this interview right now.
Yeah.
Nothing but audio. But the technologies were, of course, beginning to rapidly change then. We moved into advanced applications of video-based technologies, compressed video. It's certainly the beginnings of the online era, the early 90s, right around there, at least in terms of being ubiquitous around education. So that was sort of my opening act in this field. I spent most of the 90s working in outreach, just university outreach, three or four major U.S. universities, institutions that were all trying to be a little bit ahead of the game when it came to technology. From a historical standpoint, it was an interesting time, too, because it was at a time when, at least in the U.S., each state was beginning to build statewide telecommunications networks, which usually meant audio, video, and online to some degree. So just a flurry of activity going on there in the early, mid-90s. And then as online came into it, it just was changing pretty much everything we did. I was getting into more writing and more scholarly kinds of activities in the field, probably in the late 90s. I did some writing with the American Journal of Distance Education early with Michael Moore when that journal began. So I guess I would say that the first 10 years of my career was pretty much focused on doing it. The first job I ever had as a director of distance education, my president called me in and said, "You're now the director of distance education." and I said, "Well, I've never done it." "Well, you're going to do it now." He says, our competitors are doing this, so we want to do it too. You know, and that was very common in those days. That's the way you went into it, you know. And so then you start backtracking into literature and research to find out just what had gone on before. That was sort of my introduction by fire, okay? Perhaps the only other distinguishing factor that may or may not be of interest is, you know, even today, the number of open universities around the world makes up a really small minority of the total distance learning institutions. Mm-hmm. Most institutions are dual mode. I think there's some areas around that single mode, dual mode, that could be very interesting in terms of scholarship. Jump ahead to the early, to about 2007, I decided to take a position as the chief executive of the Observatory on Borderless Higher Education, which was sometimes called or referred to as transnational education, based in London. I had already had connections at the OEU, but had really never done any work with them. And one of the benefits of my position at the time is Brenda Gourley was on my board. She was the vice chancellor of the OU at the time. She had come in after John Daniel. And so I got a nice link to the OU very quickly when I got to the UK, which was, again, a great opportunity for learning about open universities and some of the challenges. In particular, countries where funding emanates from the national level. Yeah. I had been used to the states and like Canada and the U.S., where funding for higher education is primarily a state function. Okay, there is some financial monies that come from the federal government, but today it's a very, very, very small percentage. I spent almost 4 years in the U.K. And then in latter part of 2011-12, I had a consulting offer to go to the United Arab Emirates to help a consortium of institutions called the Higher Colleges of Technology develop a strategic plan. It was supposed to last 3 months. It lasted almost 2 years. Not because there were any major problems. It's just that I got there. We had some other things to do. And so I stayed for 2 years and ended up going to Charles Stewart in Australia. Mm. And then when I was done at CSU, I come back to Romania and have continued to teach for Oldenburg University in Germany and for the University of Maryland Global Campus and consult and do some of that. So the last 3 years have been more on the consulting side of things. I like keeping teaching in my repertoire. It's good to stay connected with students and hear their issues. And, you know, we sometimes get so preoccupied with our writing and our keynotes and everything else, you know, we forget that, you know, there's actually stuff still going on out there. You know, that's sort of a synopsis professionally.
So, Don, you've mentioned some of the work you've done around leadership, international education, change management. What are some of the ideas and themes that your work has provided over the last 30 years that you sense are still pertinent today?
Publication and research, and I've sort of drawn this out a little bit, but early in my career, the first issue that was on my radar screen was faculty are not buying into this.
Yeah.
I still hear it today. Mm-hmm. That's where my scholarship started. It was, okay, what are the incentives? What are the things that we need to look at as incentives for faculty? What I was seeing on the ground was a lot of really good technology people who could talk techno-speak. But when you're in the office of an assistant professor who's got 2 years under his or her belt, and they're on a tenure track and they're being told they need to publish and do all these other things, you know, having the technology person beat down their door is not exactly a good way to make an impression. And I was finding that a lot of faculty were just turned off by this. So I started exploring, you know, what are the issues to faculty? And lo and behold, what I found initially was, of course, it's incentives, but what incentives? Well, primarily how it applies towards promotion and tenure, and also the scope of activities, not just teaching on technology, but if you're doing design work, evaluation work, and in the early years, you know, we weren't looking at all those areas for promotion and tenure. So again, the first 10 years of my career, as I said earlier, were more focused on leading and managing and directing distance learning organizations. My scholarship was centered around issues related to management and leadership. What kinds of skills did a leader need to be able to manage the culture, not the ethnic culture, the organizational culture of the academy, to be successful in that role as a director or as a dean of distance education? Of course, when I went international, the observatory forced me to look at international education, transnational issues, global open and distance learning. And so my scholarship actually moved more to things around international education. I was very interested in this whole idea of education across cultures. What are the implications of that for language, for understanding the local culture? How does that play into how we teach and how we lead? And even today, those are still issues that I find really interesting. The other area that sort of was an impetus of the Open University was I was around when OpenLearn was sort of in its heyday, before FutureLearn. Yeah. So it really opened my eyes to open education. Mm-hmm. And so from about 2008 until the present, everything to do with OERs, open content, open source, and particularly sustainable business models in open have been certainly of interest to me. So that's a really brief snapshot of my scholarship. I'm not sure it's changed that much today. I think today my focus is being pushed towards leadership. I just see that as being absolutely critical. And I've come to the conclusion, although I'm a little weak on the data, but I'm working on it, that the capacity to actually lead change, implement and lead change, may be the single most important leadership attribute. And the distinction I make there is, I'm not talking about being able to write a change plan. I'm not talking about being able to go out and give a great speech about, you know, our new vision and where we're going. Where I see leaders falling down is when they go to the implementation stage.
Yeah.
They either don't stay with it, they don't delegate appropriately in terms of their key staff and personnel, and pretty soon it grinds to a halt, or all of a sudden everybody gets up one morning and comes to work and the organization looks pretty much the way it looked a year or 2 years ago. So it's an area that I'm increasingly interested in. I think everyone who publishes and does research remembers the first article they wrote that they thought actually was pretty good, which isn't necessarily the first article. And in the mid-90s, I published an article with a colleague of mine from Penn State in the American Journal of Distance Education with Michael around a faculty support model for distance education. It's evolved over the years, and I think people adapted and used it in different ways, particularly probably in the North American context, more so than maybe certainly in single mode institutions. But I think that whole area of what kind of support systems need to be around faculty in all of this. The issue is still here, and we laughed about it earlier, but it is an important issue. I think we need to remember that we may run around all the conferences and do all these wonderful things, but the people in the trenches that are making us look good are our teaching faculty, and I've never forgotten that. They're key to what we do, and I think they deserve to be treated well. And I think part of that is certainly incentives and the services we provide, but also just a reminder of, and recognition that these people should be treated with a level of integrity and respect for the many things they do and we ask them to do. So I think that's one area. Another area that I did some work on, particularly as I mentioned in the first part of my career, because I was doing a lot of management of DE organizations, was building interinstitutional collaborations, partnerships where maybe it made more sense for two or three institutions to contribute curriculum to a distance degree rather than one institution to do it all. It seems common sense, but the old competitive drive gets in the way sometimes. But, you know, if I asked six deans of business to come together, they came together, and we did this back in the 90s. At the same time, if I took them aside and asked each one of them which one had the best program, each one of them would say, I do.
And I'm sure they're all right.
That's right, right. So I think that was something that, I think that was a good contribution. I think it fit with the whole faculty support model. And so I think that kind of thinking about, you know, what can we do with multiple institutions, I think that had some traction, maybe for a while, maybe not as much so today, because we take partnerships to be sort of a mainstay of what we do today. But that would be one. When I was with the observatory, I published an observation, and I stand by it even in 2020, and I said, internationalism is going to run into an issue that I called at the time new global regionalism. Mm. What I meant by that was the majority of international students go to the US, the UK, and Australia, okay? And then Germany and France. As the Asian universities have gotten better, my hypothesis was students of the future may stay home. They may not feel like they need to come to the UK or the US or Australia for their degrees. Now, many will. They'll do that, okay? And I think we're seeing that right now play out. Now, part of that's being driven by the pandemic. But I think this regional kind of, I don't know what we call it, heritage, nationalism, maybe it's just plain common sense. As our institutions get better, as technology has evolved, these different regions are feeling like, well, students can take advantage of our programs here in the region. So is that going to play out? I don't know. I guess we're going to find out.
Certainly, you're really a mention of leadership and change management. Seems to be at quite an interesting stage of how online education is progressing. So you mentioned earlier the COVID-19 crisis, the lockdown that's taken place across many countries. There seems to be a new interest in online education. And I think without that leadership and change management you mentioned earlier, we may not be able to actually make much more advance in this area. Can you comment on that a little bit?
Well, I suspect that a lot of our colleagues probably are probably sure that a brave new world has finally come. But it's also come three times before, at least in my lifetime. Yeah. But it didn't quite live up to, you know, what the predictions and the futurists would tell us. For the pandemic, it's a really difficult exercise of analysis, in my view, partially because, first, teachers had no options. Secondly, they were being told to do this. And so really the only two options available is to do nothing or try to move something online. And what we've learned is that, you know, a lot of public schools, a lot of universities were not prepared to do that, that their faculty didn't have the training, the services weren't in play. And in spite of all of that, I've been very impressed. We asked the impossible of these people. I would even go as far to say I'm a little dismayed with some quarters in the writing community that have made a point to belabor this point of, you know, this is not high quality online learning. No, it isn't. How could it be? Nobody argues that, and it's great that we have people advocating for quality in online delivery. I like that part of it. But let's be fair, too, because these teachers were told by leaders, principals or rectors or vice chancellors, this is what we're going to do. And I think they've done the best they could under the circumstances.
Yeah.
Now, it isn't the standard that we want to emulate. We know that. I think the most important period is coming in the next year, because you have thousands of organizations out there now that have to grapple first with that single question. Are we going to make this a mainstay of our operations? And we all can sit here and others can sit here and say, well, yeah, that's just natural. Everybody's going to do it. Well, we don't know that. In public education, it's not competitive in terms of fees and those kinds of things like it is in higher education. I think K-12 adoption organizationally may lag behind. I think schools will be better prepared for anything, hopefully not a pandemic, but any kind of an emergency kind of approach in the future. Universities, I'm almost reluctant to really say how it's all going to play out. I wrote an editorial for the Asian Journal of Distance Education here recently, and what I said was, you got the first group, and that's the ones that are the new kids on the block. And that's the ones that were forced to get in this with no experience before the pandemic.
Yeah.
Then you have the group of institutions, and this is primarily dual mode institutions at the university level who are already doing some distance education. Now they got to decide, are we going to do more? What's that balance between face-to-face and distance going to be in the future? So they have a decision. And then I think you've got a third phase, which is going to be, how do you embed this new structure, this new culture, this new vision, these new values into your organization for the long term? And that sort of relates to what I was sharing earlier about leadership and how you implement change and make it sustainable. So I think it's an interesting period. Again, I applaud the efforts of all of our colleagues at all levels who have responded to this. But I'm also cognizant of the fact that we asked them to do an almost impossible task, at least to do it well. But at the same time, it's brought the quality issue up. You know, I was telling somebody the other day that I had not heard the word remote in 30 years. And it's being used everywhere now as basically to distinguish between high-quality online learning and emergency remote learning. Okay, come on. You know, let's be honest, our profession sure likes its language sometimes. And sometimes we confuse ourselves as much as we confuse everybody else. So anyway, I'm optimistic about the future. I think it's going to bring some really some interesting responses. How that will play out for the market, particularly in higher education, wow. Stay tuned. Yeah, put on your seatbelt and let's go.
I think you're quite right to congratulate those who embraced the challenge of online learning under the circumstances. I think the circumstances changed, but not the context. So people were asked to do pretty much what they did in the classroom online. So there was no real opportunity to revisit the fundamentals of what education is all about. So yeah, I'm quite with you there. I think everybody did the best job they possibly could. And our challenge now is to challenge the context in which education takes place.
Oh boy, you're right on the money there. I'm sort of a, you know, they should put me in a church sometimes because communication, culture, context. I echo this in just about everything I do. It changes so much of how you approach challenges, issues, even the process of teaching and learning. I tend to get into very boisterous discussions when people say, technology changes the way you learn. And I say, well, let's think about this for a minute, okay? Now, I'm a real advocate of Jean Piaget and his theory of learning and cognitive adaptation. Granted, I'll say connectivism, if you want to use that, or constructivism, either one, you know. Yes, we get sources of knowledge and information from many different sources. We process those. But do we process that information any differently than we did before? I don't have a definitive answer, but it seems to me, you know, Piaget would say when we're approached with new knowledge, if it's something that connects with our existing knowledge structures, it flows in and we find a nice place to put it and we learn. If it doesn't fit, then he argues we accommodate that new learning by changing the structures, and then we put it in place. So I think these kinds of questions, not only of context, but even of how we interpret theory within those contexts, is very exciting in a lot of ways, you know, because oftentimes we do the initial 10-year run through with our theories, and then they don't get a lot of airplay after that. And I think it's really good to revisit our theories occasionally.
Well, Don, it's now mid-2020. What are your observations about online learning and education at the present time?
I think certainly at the higher ed level, it's going to just get increasingly more competitive. I just don't see that changing, which means students will have more choices, which means being online is not going to be a differentiator.
Yeah.
Everybody's online. So then you've got to build a benefits package that differentiates you from your competitors. Mm. Now, some of those factors are, you know, necessarily ones we would normally think about: cost, quality of services, flexibility in the sense of, do we start looking at, you know, accelerated 4-week sessions as opposed to 15-week sessions or 5-week sessions? Does that become a competitive advantage for us as academics and as administrators? And we might say, well, my, no, we're not going to do that. Students may say, oh, wow, yeah, that's cool. Yeah. That would be great. You know, so again, are we willing to truly listen to our students, or are we going to make those decisions for them? But again, my point here really is that what are the, you know, the composite factors that will go into students making those choices? Now, you're going to have a lot of students who are going to go where they're going to go. You know, they want to go to a particular institution, or their families or their parents went there. That's not going to change. But I think for the average school leaver looking for university education, that decision becomes much more important. Quality will remain front and center. I would just echo what we talked about just a moment ago, that language, context, culture, communications are really, really, really important.
Mm. Don, can you tell me about some of the research you'd most like to see? Imagine I gave you an infinite budget. Where would you invest it?
Well, I think a beach house in Dunedin would be a good start. Well, I think models on global delivery. Mm. What's it going to take to be able to play in that market and be effective? In other words, that student who wants to come to New Zealand can't come now and maybe will choose not to come in the future. Do you have an option of attracting that student and similar students to an online version? Or will they just say, nah, I'll just take a degree here in the region, because I can take an online degree here in the region too, because Asian universities have picked up their game a little bit in terms of what they offer. So I think that whole area is going to be really an interesting area. So I think we're going to need more models. You know, I don't have the data on actual numbers from all the institutions, but everything suggests that the numbers are nowhere what we would think they would be. They certainly don't match what national growth was or statewide growth in North America or provincial growth in Canada. So in some ways, that's a wide open market. And how do you make it work? How do you compete, if you have to, against the Stanfords and the Sydneys and those elite institutions who have unlimited resources? Well, maybe not unlimited, but certainly have resources, more than most of us have. I'd like to see more research around OERs, but specifically around institutional assimilation and adoption into the mainstream culture. every activity I've been engaged with for the last 10 years around open education just doesn't seem to see that issue. We jump right away to, you know, we're either creating OERs or we're creating a repository. And my response is, well, you've got a faculty group there in which we have taught for centuries exactly the opposite of what you want them to do. We have taught them that their role in this universe is to push back the frontiers of knowledge through scholarly research and inquiry, and that that research is your lifeblood for your career, for your promotion, everything you do. And now all of a sudden we want to pull up the curtain and say, oh, and by the way, give it away all free for nothing. Okay. It's sort of what I said earlier about faculty adoption early in my career and the issues that I observed. Yeah. It's the culture. It's inside that culture, and it's the informal parts of that culture as well. Mm-hmm. I spent 2 years working for a president, and my job was to rewrite promotion and tenure guidelines of the university to accommodate distance education and distance learning. Yeah. 2 years, worked with the faculty senate, worked with the unions, worked with everybody, and we finally made incredible progress. Put it into practice, a year later, no changes. On the ground, what was going on is senior faculty were telling young faculty who had been there 2 or 3 years, you want to get promoted, focus on your research. Don't focus on distance learning. So you wouldn't find it written anywhere, but on the ground within that informal culture of the way we do things, the way I present this to my leadership students is you have the formal culture, which is all the procedures and processes and everything. And then you have the informal culture. And what that really is how we really do things around here. And how we really do things around here is, you know, it's not publicized, it's quiet, but it's effective. And eventually time played a role in moving us forward. But wow, it was a real lesson in terms of understanding how the norms of a culture can either help you or hurt you when you're trying to facilitate change.
Excellent. Don, it's been an incredibly rich career for you, and no doubt you've been influenced by quite a few people. Who are two people you'd recommend as legends of online learning, one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you now, and one who you think otherwise has an important perspective to share?
I don't think you've interviewed Mpini Meko.
That would be right.
From the University of South Africa. Fascinating career, educated primarily in the United States, but her entire career has primarily been in South Africa. Yeah. She and I are pretty good friends, and just some of the contemporary stories. I mean, we've never even gotten into, you know, what was it like 25 years ago coming out of apartheid. I think Professor Meko would be an excellent addition. I've got one more who I think is sort of on the cusp. Her name is Dr. Lisa Marie Blask, out of Germany. Very involved with Eden. Was on the executive committee, probably with you, I would guess.
Yes, I know Lisa.
You said online learning, and boy, they don't come any better when it comes to understanding the different frames in terms of design and theory and actually teaching. And I've taught with her for 10 years, and I can attest to her talent as an online teacher.
Thanks, Don. It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you. I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much for being a leader and legend of online learning.
Yeah, well, I got to give you a footnote here, and that is I was telling my wife about this interview last night, and she says, legend? And she says, I thought you told me that legends from your country are people like Michael Jordan and Barbara Streisand and Clint Eastwood.
You can learn more about Don and link to some of his work through our website.
That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com. This episode kindly produced by Nev Allington.